Hey guys, Mike with FlightBridge Ed. I've been an EMS training officer since 2008, and I don't know how many times I've had to deliver the bad news to someone about an expired certification. That means no work. That's where Piace comes in to save the day. Never be caught off guard again with an expired cert. Go to the App Store for your device and search for Piace, P-I-A-C-E-T, the one-stop application to manage and share all of your certifications. You know you don't want to be that guy or gal, and don't rely on your agency to tell you about your certifications. Go to Piace to manage your own certs and have some peace of mind. Download Piace today.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
So, my name is James Boomhauer, and I'm going to talk to you about mental health and cumulative stress in EMS. So, like every good critical care transport professional, I have to be to work in about 16 hours. So when I'm done with this, I'm hopping on a plane and headed back to Boston. I wish I had more time to do Q&A. I tried to catch some people yesterday to talk about that. So I want to make sure you guys have these resources here. Stay Fit for Duty on the Instagram and Twitter are new. So if you look at that and say, this kid doesn't know what he's talking about because all of this is blank, it's brand new. But I wanted to give you guys sort of an anonymous outlet to talk about this, because step one is destigmatizing, but a very close step 1A is just having a place to talk about it. And I think if we have a nice anonymous place, it's not jboomhauer@gmail.com, it's on my personal Instagram, my personal Twitter, where you guys can start this conversation and ask these questions, then we'll be in a good spot. If you're gonna tag me on any form of social media at all, I ask you to please use the hashtag #StayFitForDuty. My conversation starts with that handsome, goofy smile dude leaning up next to his helicopter. That is critical care transport specialist James Boomhauer. Now, anyone here who's in flight medicine, anyone here who wants to be in flight medicine knows that I did not walk up to Michael Frakes, said, hey, what's up? They call me Boomer. I'm pretty good at this. He handed me a onesie and I went to work. Right? That's not how this happened. There's an 80-pound weight loss to make flight weight. There was board certification. There was moving to another state to work for what I felt was one of the best transport teams in my area. There was an orientation. There was stress. There was chaos. There was all this stuff. Because this isn't just a guy leaning against a helicopter, and I think every single one of you in here can appreciate that. That is a transport specialist who has his wings. And that's a big day, right? You shave, you smile, you take the picture next to Flat Stanley, you do the thing. And what I want to talk to you guys about is how okay I was and how perfect things were, especially now that orientation's over, right? Like, people know your name and they ask you questions and you're now like an actual member of the healthcare team. I talked to you about this castle that I had. Without getting into my CV, I'll tell you that I was a provider in New York, a provider in Maine, and a provider in Massachusetts, and had a litany of friends that I considered family, actual family, loved ones, instructors, you name it, that I knew that I could reach out to at any time for any reason. The day that picture posted on Facebook, my phone exploded. You did it, you're awesome, yeah. I had an amazing castle. And a huge pillar of that castle was a woman I was dating at the time, who was no slouch in her own right, a 24-year-old with a PhD and a doctorate in physical therapy at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. So for those of you that are good on the map, you realize that we're far apart, but we are crushing the 20-something millennial power couple stigma, right? We're doing the thing, we're doing awesome. Like any good flight program, we take our newest and most dangerous, and we put them with someone to help them not kill anybody, right? I was working with a crazy senior, brilliant practicing NP, who, you know, did the med flight thing part-time when she wasn't doing the NP thing full-time. Been doing this for longer than I care to admit, and certainly that they'd care for me to admit to you guys. Could do this job with her eyes closed and one hand tied behind her back. My objectives for the day were to not lose anything and to try really hard to not make anyone worse. My cognitive offloading here is zero. And let's not forget that I'm fresh off of orientation. I read all the binders that was given to me by my employer, and I know all my protocols cold. Right, the jump from 911 to critical care on that side is easy. Okay, the dose here is 2 grams, got it. Easy, simple, squared away. The pager goes off for a rotaring request of a 34-year-old man suffering from a GI bleed. And I love this part when I give this talk, because every clinician in the room goes, all right? And you either want to know more or you don't want to know anything, right? Because I either want to know there's octreotide, there's blood, there's surgical intervention, we're direct to OR, or this is going to be, I had a little bit of blood in my poo and a stand and pivot to the stretcher and we're flying because somebody got nervous. But the lack of information here gives me some pause and some stress all at the same time. So we load up our aircraft, we make our way to the hospital. We land, we do the thing, hey, hi, how are you? And the first thing that I notice about this call is that the physician is really, really young. That was a laser pointer. There we go. Really young. I just blinded some guy over there, I'm sorry. Which is fine, maybe a year or two older than I was at the time, but what should alarm you is they're a physician. 19-year-old paramedics aren't new, right? We're a dime a dozen, so you work your way up the chain. Okay, 19 plus this, perfect, you're a young paramedic. You're a year older than me and you're a physician? That's awesome, but wow, so, so young. And this individual walks up to us trembling with sweaty palms and an even sweatier soap sheet. Thank you so much for coming. I'm so glad you're here. They're in room 2, and I really need your help. Like any crew, I go to start to package the patient. My partner goes to the doc, starts to get reports, signatures, all that good time stuff. And when I draw back the curtain, I see chaos. I see clinicians literally running around. I see packed red cells and vasoactive meds infusing onto the floor because no one has recognized that the manifold in the neck has snapped. I see people assigning tasks and then completing the task they just assigned and then assigning another task again, and everyone's getting mad all at the same time, which is fine. This is our job. We put out these fires. This is what we do. I walk in, and any one of you who've met me for more than 5 minutes, I say, hi, I'm James. I'm one of the paramedics with the transport team. You know, shuffle my monitor over there and try to swim my way to the patient. And then I say hello to my patient. Hey, man, how's it going? And what I think is so important for you to remember is the importance of a handshake. There's clinical importance out the wazoo. Think of the neuro exam you chip away at. When someone makes eye contact with you, they extend their hand, you can feel their skin, color, temperature, condition, can they squeeze, do they have enough proprioceptive awareness to find your hand, on for days. But not too far off from what our keynote was speaking about for corpse medics, it also reminds us that we're humans treating humans, okay? Our sim man at MedFlight is good, it's real good, it can't shake my hand. Give us time, we'll try to make one, but it can't. So it reminds us all that we're a human treating a human. And I'll tell you what this patient did was slowly gaze to the left, reach his hand up to me, and flop a pale, diaphoretic, dead hand in my palm. And said, I really don't feel that well. And as I'm getting things together, I take a look at the monitor, and this is what I see. All the clinicians in the rooms are like, well, that seems to be maybe a first degree with a quad. Perfect. And as I start to go through the universal MedFlight spiel of, let me tell you what's going to happen, a lot of things are going to happen really fast. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do the other thing. Sir, can you hear me? Now, with my educator in the room, I'm going to tell you that I took a step back, took a big breath, and said, I'm calling a code, slap the button, I need you to start chest compressions, I need you to move to the bag, I need you to get blood, get the doctor and my partner in here, please. What actually happened was, I need help in room 2! I need help in room 2! Because I have 14 other people in this room, but I have no help. And I think you can only appreciate that sentence after doing this job. There are 14 medical professionals in this room, and I have no help. So my nurse and the physician walk into the room, my nurse partner, I don't mean that with any disparity, walks into the room and her head explodes. 2 minutes, James, 2 minutes I left you with this guy and you're doing CPR and your rate's wrong. What's going on? And unfortunately, her and the physician got pulled into that cyclone that I created by going, oh my God. Until this woman, showing her seniority and her brilliance, took a big step back and went, everyone stop and look at me. And I'm just coming off orientation, right? That's muscle memory. Ma'am, yes, ma'am, right? That's just how we've been doing it. She commanded the presence of every single person in that room to lockstep and face her. I need you to restart compressions. I need you to double check that endotracheal tube and then begin to bag. I need you to hang that pack of cells. James, get more epinephrine. I need our pilot to grab equipment out of here. She took this train wreck, put it back on the tracks, and pushed it away. Let's get back in the game. Now, it sounds like I'm saying a lot of negative things about the sending facility, and I have to tell you that they were great with what they had. And one of the things that they were phenomenal at was keeping family in the loop up to and until the medical helicopter got involved. Knew he was sick. Hey, you know, pretty sick. We're gonna call MedFlight, and MedFlight's gonna fly him into Boston, and we'll give you more information in a little bit. Now, what I think is really important for everyone to remember is this man kind of got strong-armed going to the hospital by his wife. Right, listen, there's been blood in your poop for 3 days. You're telling me your belly's killing you. Let's go to the hospital. This will be easy, it'll be simple. We'll take our two children to the movies once you're done. This is an in and out for them. This is a little hiccup in a Saturday and we're all gonna be squared away. And let me tell you, as we talk about the different stressors that we interact with every day and how we utilize them in our day-to-day and how we let them affect us, I will never unhear the scream of a woman who sees this. Blood on the floor, bodies everywhere. This was a stop before the movie theater that turned into a flight team that turned into a flight team doing CPR. And we all know what we're billed as, right? When hospitals tell family they've called us, they're gonna be okay, we called MedFlight. They're gonna be fine, we called JeffStat, right? We're the heroes from on high. This is easy. We fix it and we move them on. Here we are 45 minutes later doing CPR. You can't unhear the woman headlocking her husband, listening to these pleas to survive turn into furious rants of anger. Wake up, wake up, wake up, turned into don't leave me, you son of a bitch. She's not in anybody's way. She's right where she needs to be. You can't ask somebody to leave because they're ruining your psyche, right? That's not how it works. But I can tell you that my dose of vasopressin got a whole lot harder to remember as I'm listening to that, elbows length away. So this code continues and continues and continues, and it continues for pride and a refusal to believe that we can't temporize this man enough to get us to Boston. You just gotta fit and go, and come on, give us something, give us anything. Can a Lucas fit in the aircraft? Do we have an option? Give us anything. 90 minutes into our cardiac arrest, we're declared deceased. In a job of moving people from point A to point B, when you miss the point B part, it puts a lot of spotlight on you. What are you doing? There's a person there. You're not supposed to leave. We talk to the hospital. We give our courtesies and condolences to the wife. And we leave. Pack up our stuff. Three, pilot, nurse, paramedic, mentally and physically exhausted. Our poor pilot ran at least a mile and a quarter, up, down, up, down, up, down. He would hand us a piece of equipment and we'd say, great, I need the IV bag, middle drawer, orange now, and dead sprint back up to get it and come back down. Over and over and over again. We throw away what can be thrown away. We salvage what can be salvaged. We make our way back to the facility, to our hangar. Write a whole pile of paperwork, right? The QI folks in here are going, oh my God, that chart, oh, it hurts my head. All the stuff that we have to do. And we give ourselves these tertiary, you okay? Yeah. You okay? Yeah. Right? And that's it. So we're all squared away. I hop in my car, and I have an hour and 45-minute ride back home. $4.95 is not that far apart from that stock photo that I pulled, right? That's real, real close. Just a lot of straight line. And the person I need to talk to, stage one of my castle, is my girlfriend. She doesn't pick up at 3:05. She doesn't pick up at 3:07. She doesn't pick up at 3:11 when my voicemail is, pick up the fucking phone! She doesn't pick up at 3:15. At this point, her cell phone is vibrated off the nightstand, right? We get that, right? She's an adult with human hours, so it's vibrated off the nightstand. She's been sound asleep the whole time. So I get ready to walk into my house, and as we talk about the layer on layer on layer of this, I tell you that I put my key into my lock with a prayer. Because through the chaos of orientation, and through moving, and through long-distance relationship stuff, I hadn't paid rent in 2 months. And my landlord had made it pretty clear that that was gonna be okay for like another 10 seconds before he either got an envelope of cash or he changed the locks. So I'm able to go into my house. I take the bottle of my favorite whiskey. I drink all of it. And I wake up prone in a blood-covered flight suit 5 hours later. To my girlfriend's credit, I wake up to the same 9 phone calls, right? Oh my God, I was asleep, are you okay? Your voicemail sounded mad, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong? And here, right here, is where things started to go awry. What did I say when I called her back? What did I say? I'm okay, I'm fine. I'm so sorry I bothered you. Ugh, I yelled, I was a jerk, I'm sorry. Oh man, terrible call. I'm a little drunk still. I'm fine though, I'm fine, right? That typical pre-hospital paramedic nurse bravado nonsense that says, nope, didn't bother me. Sorry, yep, moment of weakness, straighten up. All good to go. What that showed me, was that castle that I showed you before? Had a little crack. And interrogating that crack just a little bit, what I really had was a pile of rubble. I had a pile of lies and whiskey and nonsense that told me that I was okay all the time. Right? This has nothing to do with the people inside the castle. That team was amazing, but the foundation of this castle that I'd built on myself was terrible and dangerous. And I come up here and I try really hard not to cry in front of my boss and a handful of my peers to share this story with you because it is important for you to know that per the CDC, one of us commits suicide every 4 days in the United States of America. Every 4 days, one of us dies. For some of us, that's a rotation. That's a schedule. I'm going to Hangar 2, I'll see you on Friday. One clinician dead. Every 4 days. I want you all to start treating your own mental health no differently than physical health of the patients that you encounter every day. I give you this long, drawn-out story because I knew every single one of you was going, Clint said, TXA, I'm gonna help that guy. You know, you didn't think about this, your compressions were terrible. We all got painted a picture of what we needed to see and we started to work through it. Our profession is brilliant at that fact over all else. We see, we fix, we move on. Why is it not the same with our own mental health? Why does this kid have a helmet? This kid has a helmet because we think it keeps the kid safe. What keeps the kid safe is knowing how to ride the bike. I can wrap him in bubble wrap and push him down 495, and if he doesn't know how to ride the bike, he's gonna die, right? That's the only option. The option is no different when we talk about mental health and suicide awareness. If we're in a 911 truck and we walk into a room with somebody holding a knife to their throat, we sedate them, we paralyze them, we intubate them, we take them to the hospital, life saved. High fives all around. You stopped someone from committing suicide. Strong work. We are very, very good as a profession in that moment. Criticality, live or die, this is our specialty. What about the 6, 8, 12, 16 months beforehand where that person gave sign after sign after sign that something was wrong, that they needed help. It is perfectly okay to not be okay. I'll tell you that through no fault of my agency, the first email I received about this call was a polite reminder that I incorrectly filled out the flow sheet. Right? Because that is very much a job of any HEMS agency, right? Got to check the paperwork. 2 weeks later, someone finally aired out the idea, hey, are you okay? And I responded with, oh yeah, me? Oh yeah, totally. New guy? Fine. Super fine. I'm not crying when I watch TV shows because there's medical people on there. No, I'm fine, fine, fine. Because I was worried about the repercussions from my place. That my place had nothing to do with, right? That was an entirely self-made, EMS-specific thing that we do in EMS critical care and in fire. I want you to look at your teammates like you look at your patients. The peer support teams can be phenomenally helpful, and I genuinely hope that I get to come back for Fast 19 and tell you how well ours worked, because we started it a week ago. And the response I got when I shot out an email saying, hey, does anybody want to help me make sure we're all okay? We'll take some classes, we'll learn how to talk to people, and we'll just keep tabs on one another. The emails were phenomenal and instant. We all know our stuff. I know that you're going through a nasty divorce. I know that you just had two kids and you're not getting any sleep. You know that I'm a hot mess who's globetrotting around the country giving this talk. Lord knows if I'm going to be awake for my shift tomorrow. We already know all of this stuff about one another. And we watch these people spiral, and what do? Hot mess over there. He didn't even remember his dose of vasopressin yesterday. What a loser, right? Without anybody saying, hey man, everything okay? Can I help you? What do you need? Until we get to that absolutely critical, pivotal, I'm gonna end it all. Or, as unbelievably heart-wrenching as it is, the phone call and hey, you don't have a partner on Fridays anymore. You lost a friend, you lost a brother, you lost a sister. The third step to this is recognizing when you're not okay. Just as important to be able to look in the mirror and say, I really need to make sure that I'm okay. And then I need to be able to ask for help. If we take some time and have some patience and some practice and some openness, this can be managed peer to peer or self to self, just as straightforward and as ready as this. This statistic is a challenge. We are sitting through 2 days of critical care symposium where we're saying the data shows this, the data shows that, the data shows that, and we are changing our care reflective to that data each and every time. We have two options right now. We can fix it, and we can make this every 5 days, every 7 days, every 14 days, or we can watch it tick closer and closer and closer to our keynote statistic of a war veteran every minute and change. This will not stay the same. So we are the ones that can decide, do we make it better or do we let it spiral out of control? I say let's fix it. Thanks for your time.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.